It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we'll look at prison conditions in Iran and here in the U.S. Journalists Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord will join us to discuss the week's news and their new book, Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Their experience with solitary confinement in the notorious Evin prison in Iran got them interested in reporting on solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. Where do you see good coverage of mass incarceration in America? What stories resonate with you, and what turns you off? It's your call with me, Holly Kernan, and you after this news.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. Ukraine says pro-Russian militants have suffered heavy losses during the government operation against the insurgent-controlled city of Slovyansk. The acting president, Oleksandr Turchynov, said two Ukrainian soldiers were also killed. Two government helicopters were shot down. Ukrainian forces are reported to have taken control of a number of checkpoints around the city. Fergal Keane reports from the region.
Slovyansk is the heartland of militant opposition, and throughout the day, pro-Russian forces maintained they were holding the government at bay. For its part, the state claimed many rebels had been killed, injured or arrested. But it's been impossible to verify this. Around Slovyansk, the atmosphere is tense. On the bridge at Andreevka, about 6 miles from the city, we witnessed a standoff between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian demonstrators. A soldier told me the demonstrators were standing for Russia and not Ukraine. The troops seemed in no mood for further confrontation, and it is significant that the president himself acknowledged the operation in Slovyansk is going more slowly than had been hoped.
Russia has demanded an immediate stop to the Ukrainian military operation, saying it could lead to a catastrophe. Moscow accused the authorities in Kiev of what it called criminal incompetence and of murdering their own citizens. But President Obama has defended it as a legitimate attempt to restore order. After talks with the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, he warned that more sanctions would be imposed on Russia if it didn't stop supporting the militants.
As Ukrainian forces move to restore order in eastern Ukraine, it is obvious to the world that these Russian-backed groups are not peaceful protesters. They are heavily armed militants who are receiving significant support from Russia. The Ukrainian government has the right and responsibility to uphold law and order within its territory, and Russia needs to use its influence over these paramilitary groups so they disarm and stop provoking violence.
Mrs. Merkel said Europe was prepared to back sanctions targeting entire sectors of the Russian economy. The United Nations in Afghanistan says at least 350 people have been killed in a landslide in the northeast of the country. Around 2,000 are missing after a section of a mountain collapsed on a village following torrential rain in Badakhshan province. From Kabul, David Loyne.
Much of north and east Afghanistan has been hit by torrential rain in recent days. Around 150 people died in flooding last week. But now reports are coming in of a disaster on a far bigger scale. 1,000 houses were affected, 300 of them buried immediately after the side of a mountain slipped downwards. As it was Friday morning, a day off in Afghanistan, people were at home when the landslip happened, and whole families are lost under tons of mud. Hundreds of other houses are threatened.
World News from the BBC. The US Secretary of State John Kerry says the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has agreed to peace talks aimed at ending the conflict in the country. Mr. Kerry, on a visit to South Sudan, said the meeting between Mr. Kiir and the rebel leader Riek Machar could take place as early as next week. The United Nations says delayed rains and continued instability in Somalia are likely to worsen food security in the country. The UN Food Agency, the FAO, said the worst affected areas were the main maize producing in southern Somalia and the northeast. The North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has dismissed his top military commander, the latest in a series of reshuffles and purges in the leadership. Vice Marshal Choi Ryong-hae has been replaced by Hwang Pyong-soo, a previously little-known official who's had a meteoric rise through the army ranks. Charles Scanlon reports.
Choi Ryong-hae has long been seen as a loyal family retainer. He appeared to be the key power behind the throne when the leader Kim Jong-un turned on his uncle late last year and had him executed for treason. But soon afterwards, Che's public appearances began to dwindle, leading to speculation he'd been purged as well. The new man, Hwang Pyeong-so, was pictured by state media smiling broadly and taking notes in the leader's entourage during a visit to a textile factory. He's in his 60s and was an official in the ruling party before his sudden promotion to the revered military rank of vice marshal.
One of Britain's best-known celebrity publicists, Max Clifford, has been sentenced to 8 years in prison for 8 counts of indecent assault on women and teenage girls. Describing Clifford's attitude as contemptuous, the judge sentencing him in London said he'd shown no remorse for the offences. Max Clifford was arrested and charged as part of a wider investigation into allegations of historical sex attacks by celebrities. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, Iraq held elections this week, Iran's dealing with a prison crisis, and in the U.S. there was a botched execution in an Oklahoma prison. We'll talk about the week's news with two journalists, Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord. They're out with a new book, Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. In 2009, these two young Americans were living in Syria. Their friend Josh came for a visit from the U.S., and the three went traveling. They were on a hike on the Iran-Iraq border. They were arrested by Iran, called spies, and ended up spending 2 years in Iranian prisons. Their experience with solitary confinement in the notorious Evin prison led them to report on solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. So how do you view media coverage of the massive prison system in the U.S., which is the largest in the world? We always start off Fridays with kudos to journalists who do especially good reporting during the week. So let's start there, Shane. What do you want to highlight?
I would give kudos to Nick Bauman at Mother Jones. He came out with a story this week on an American citizen who was living in South Sudan who was being pressured by the FBI to spy for them, and he goes in detail into how the FBI start harassing his family and him, and actually has recordings of the FBI kind of threatening him over the phone. It's a really good, important piece of journalism.
And we'll link to that at our website, yourcallradio.org. You can also post articles that you like there. Sarah, what do you want to shout out to in terms of good journalism this week? Do we have Sarah?
Yes.
Hi, sorry about that. Sarah, will you start again? We somehow lost you there for a minute.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Good morning. I'd like to highlight the PBS Frontline documentary called Solitary Nation. It actually came out last week, but it's such an extraordinary, really unprecedented piece on solitary confinement inside U.S. prisons. I want to make sure your audience doesn't miss it. It takes place, the videographer and filmmakers were able to get access to the solitary units in Maine prisons for over a year, and they filmed just unbelievably horrific events, that just the pure senseless brutality of solitary confinement, I think, has never been better captured. They suicides, self-mutilation, this unbelievable in clinical insanity of the inmates stuck in these solitary cells in Maine.
All right, that is Solitary Nation. It's a PBS Frontline documentary. We'll link to all of this. And we want to hear from our listeners. If you have a particular piece of journalism that you want to highlight, you can go to yourcalledradio.org. And we'll talk more about solitary confinement with journalists Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord. Their new book is Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And I want to ask you both about the recent reports coming out of Iran of brutal treatment of political prisoners in Evin prison. Recently, the Iranian opposition website Kalame reported that more than 100 prison guards attacked political prisoners in Ward 350 of Evin prison. Dozens were beat up, more than 30 prisoners were injured, and 32 prisoners were transferred to solitary confinement. Human Rights Watch puts the number of political prisoners in Iran at 1,000. What do you guys know about these attacks, Shane?
Well, what's interesting to me about these attacks is, one, you know, it's unusual in that it was so many people, you know, at once. But it's also not surprising. I mean, there's when we were in Evin prison, you know, we talked to people who had been, you know, beaten at the bottom of their feet, electrocuted, had their hair pulled out. I mean, really brutal stuff happening. So it's not unprecedented. It's strange in that it happened to so many people at once. But, you know, people are beaten there periodically. But what to me, what is really amazing about what's happening around this now is that there are actually protests outside around this. The families have been protesting outside of government offices publicly and taking risks that really people haven't taken, you know, since I would say 2009, 2010 with the post-election protests. And it's kind of a different crowd. You know, it's families mm-hmm. putting themselves in the line.
One of the prisoners managed to send out a letter to his family and said they made us stand in a row facing the wall in Ward 350's corridors while being handcuffed and blindfolded. They started to beat us up from behind. You could hear a whining noise outside the ward's gate. The guards stood like a tunnel and forced us to go through it before taking us to a minibus, and you could see blood on the way inside of the minibus. Sarah, are you there with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
So you were both in Evin prison, but in another ward. How did this resonate with what you saw during your imprisonment, Sarah?
Well, I mean, something this large scale, a raid from the Revolutionary Guard, like you said, a gauntlet of guards with batons and a path of blood. This kind of mass beating, for me, with my experience of how, and of course it's always very shrouded in mystery, how the internal workings of the Iranian government actually work, but from my experience, nothing like this could happen without at least tacit approval from, you know, the highest level, from the supreme leader. Of course, I don't know that, but everything that happened after I was released after a year in solitary confinement at Evin, and I worked on Shane and Josh's case and advocated for their release, I was working really closely with the Omani government that had direct contact with President Ahmadinejad's office and the supreme leader, and something with this large scale, from my experience, would either be something planned to actually discredit Rouhani, you know, the Revolutionary Guard being unhappy with his overtures towards the West, or come, you know, straight from the supreme leader. So, of course, we never saw anything this large scale, but when I was in Evin, even though I was isolated, the other women would reach out to me, and they would pass me notes, they would say things to me as they walked blindfolded down the hallway past my cell, and I saw women limping past me, I saw women bloody. There was one woman that had to hang onto the wall, and it took her 20 minutes to walk down, you know, 20 feet of hallway because she'd obviously been beaten so badly. And the women, the closest friend that I made in prison was Zahra Bahrami, the Dutch Iranian activist that was later executed on what I believe are most likely false drug charges. She was picked up at the Ashura protest in 2009. And Zahra told me that she was beaten at the bottom of her feet, that she had a hard time standing, and that she was tortured.
And then she was ultimately executed, but she was somebody who communicated with you when you were in solitary and gave you a lot of hope, saying that she had seen your mom on TV and that your mom was advocating for you and all of that.
Yeah, she was absolutely incredible. I mean, dozens of women risked, I don't know what they were risking, but took incredible risks to reach out to me in my solitary. I was the only woman in my corridor that was kept in solitary anywhere near as long as I was. Most women, after a few weeks, they were put in cells together, and they would sing songs to me down the hallway. They would yell that they loved me. They would sing Michael Jackson's "You Are Not Alone." At one point, I was taken to the clinic because I had some health concerns, and there were many women in the waiting room of the clinic, and they were able to talk to each other, and the guards had me in a corner, and they were sort of surrounding me and isolating me from the rest, and one woman pushed past the guard and threw her arms around me and told me that she loved me and she hoped I would be free.
Hmm. That's really moving. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Krennan, and I'm speaking with journalists Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord. They're out with a new book, Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And Sarah, you just mentioned isolation, and you write a lot about that in the book. You say, Sarah, that you completely lost your sanity, that solitary reduces you to an animalistic state. I think you wrote, my time in my cell has become less and less structured as I get more depressed. I talk to myself, eat my food with my hand like an animal. I spend hours crouched by the slot at the bottom of my door listening for sounds. These symptoms scare me. So can both of you talk about your experience in solitary and how it's led you to do the work that you're doing now? Go ahead and start us off, Sarah, because you were...
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I still ask myself today how it is that I kept my sanity, and because many, many people don't. In this country, there are some reports that say that suicide is 50% higher in solitary confinement than it is in the general population in U.S. prisons. People can't cope without other human contact, especially when you're in a dangerous place, in a, you know, the worst crisis of your life, in a state of total uncertainty where you have no idea when you're ever going to be able to see the sky again or touch another human being. You need human contact, and without that, your mind starts to decompensate. There are studies that have shown that after 2 or 3 days, people in solitary confinement, their brain waves will shift towards stupor or delirium. And I was in for 410 days. The UN says that 15 days can cause permanent or lasting damage, psychological damage, and constitute torture. So I think that what kept me going is that I had Shane and Josh. The passage of the book that you just read, my worst breakdown, where I screamed and beat at the walls of my cell until my knuckles were bloody, that scared our interrogators. They didn't want, we were valuable, you know, hostages. They wanted to trade us in for something from the U.S. government. They wanted to also, they knew that they would eventually have to release us, and they didn't want us coming out looking terrible or totally insane. So they started to let me have short periods every day with Shane and Josh. I was still in solitary confinement, but that was my lifeline. That kept me going. And I think the other thing is just knowing that I wasn't forgotten, and that's what's so important with this, you know, what they're calling Black Thursday, what we were talking about, the Revolutionary Guard raid and mass beating that just happened in Iran, the solidarity on the outside, all of these people shaving their heads mm-hmm. in solidarity is just the most powerful thing. That's what keeps prisoners going. That's what keeps them, you know, sane and able to keep fighting and resisting.
And Shane, you write about being in solitary. You spent 4 months before right. you and Josh were then moved into a yeah. cell together.
Yeah. You know, there were times when I was in solitary confinement that I just kind of broke. And throughout the time I was at Evin, I would always hear new people that come into the prison that they always kind of enter and are put in solitary confinement where they're being interrogated. And people would always break, you know. But, you know,
what does that mean when you say break?
You know, for me, it was just kind of, there were days that I was just pacing, trying to kind of keep my mind steady, trying to pass the time. I was, you know, afraid. I was unable to get outside of all of the thoughts that were kind of spinning through my head. And at some point, I just couldn't do it, and I would just... literally fall to the ground and weep, you know, and this was common for a lot of people coming through. And then, you know, that you kind of get through that time period, and for the rest of the time, I never really knew if I was like kind of losing my mind or not, because there's no one off whom to reflect, you know. It's just a situation that is completely different from any other context that we find ourselves in, you know. We all know what it's like to spend some moments or a day alone, but when we have no interaction with anybody, we can't even really see ourselves in a sense, you know.
And you know you're completely powerless.
Right, and I notice my thoughts starting to slow down without having conversation. It was hard for me to even have internal conversation. I became obsessed with anything that had to do with time passing, like the light you know, moving across my wall from my window. That was an indicator of time. And all I wanted was time to pass. I would sleep as much as I could. I would, you know, watch. I would put some of my lunch on the ground so the ants would come and I could watch them. Anything to get me out of my head. And it's very, very difficult to do that when you have no one else. And, you know, I start wanting to be interrogated. I wanted to just have
human contact.
A conversation, yeah.
What was your relationship with your guards like? Sarah writes about that you had a guard who was somewhat kind to you up until a point. Sarah, what? I mean, it's a very intimate relationship in so many ways, and yet the power dynamics are frightening.
Yeah.
Well, in the beginning, I was I didn't for a long time admit to myself or let myself believe that our situation was that bad. I mean, in the initial months, I assumed that it would be resolved once we went to court. My interrogator told me, "I know that you're not a spy. This is, you know, we just need to prove that to the judge." But when my interrogator came back after 2 months and said that our case had become political and that what he said up to that point was false, that we weren't going to go to court, and if we did, it wouldn't be a good thing for us, that we may be there for a very long time. The whole house of cards sort of fell down, and I realized that this man had really been manipulating me or trying to make himself feel better by being kind to me, giving me extra books, showing me pictures. I mean, he obviously had his own internal, you know, struggle and issues over what he was doing with his life, and the fact that he knew that we were innocent and that we were being used as pawns. You know, he struggled with that on a certain level, but he was still doing it. And ultimately, I lost all respect for him because, despite the fact that he was participating in perpetuating this system, and just trying to cover it up with nice words.
And you're listening to Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we're speaking with journalists Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord. Their new book is Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran, and they're both now reporting on prison conditions, including solitary confinement in the U.S. And let me invite our listeners to join our conversation. The number is 866-798-TALK. There's been a lot of news about political dissidents and their treatment in Evin prison. Have you followed the human rights situation in Iran? And here at home, how much do you know about the approximately 2 million people serving time in American prisons? What kind of coverage grabs your attention? How do you think media should be covering mass incarceration and criminal justice issues? Where do you get good news about what's happening in the massive American prison system? 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number. That's 866-798-8255. And if you're somebody who's ever been imprisoned here or elsewhere, call and share your experience and tell us what you think about how incarceration is covered in media. And if you're somebody who works in a prison, we'd also love to hear your perspective. Again, the number is 866-798-8255, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So we were just talking about solitary confinement, isolation, and its effect on your mental and physical state. Sarah, in your book, you write that after Shane and Josh were put together, you became even more depressed. Shane, how did you deal with this, you know, seeing how distressed Sarah was?
It was really difficult. I mean, there were certain ways that, you know, when I think back on that time, I think of solitary confinement as the worst time, but there were also ways that the period after solitary confinement was more difficult in different ways. And that was watching Sarah. You know, Josh and I were together. She was alone. And she continued to deteriorate. She continued on that trajectory that I had been on and that Josh had been on for another 8 months or 9 months. And, you know, we would see her every day for a half hour or an hour and sometimes 2 hours. Josh and I would just kind of spend that time doing what we could to try to lift her up a little bit. And there were a lot of times that we couldn't, that she entered these really kind of dark periods where, you know, I really thought that I was losing her at times, that, you know, when she got out, she wasn't going to be the same person anymore that she was when she got in. You know, it was when she actually got released and Josh and I were still in, it was a huge relief. You know, it was, even though we were still in prison, it was like it, things, knowing that she wasn't in that situation anymore, made things easier.
Sarah, how hard was it for you to write this book, to go back to those times that Josh is talking about right now?
Well, it was definitely difficult. There were many days that I wanted to do anything but go back there and sit down in front of my desk in a cell, in a room that reminded me sometimes of the cell, because I felt, you know, stuck in there, like I had to unearth these painful memories. But ultimately, I think it was extremely beneficial that psychologically, for people that have experienced long-term solitary and prisoners in general, and people that have been through trauma in general, taking power of your narrative is one of the most important things psychologically. You lost that power, and then when you get it back, when you get your agency back, going back over the events and making sense of them and weaving them into your own personal story is a really positive thing, and I think it's helped me move forward.
And another thing that you've been doing is partnered with Solitary Watch, and you're collecting stories from people living in solitary confinement today. What kinds of stories are you hearing?
One of the most incredible things, I mean, one of the hardest things for people coming out of long-term solitary confinement is just trying to understand what happened to you in there. On a very human level, understanding the memories, putting them together, but also just what happens to the brain, what happens to your brain chemistry. Haven't been anywhere near enough studies done to tell us what happens. But my work with Solitary Watch has really helped me, because the stories that I've gleaned through in-depth letter correspondences and prison visits and interviews with survivors helped me understand what happened to me. A lot of people experienced very much the same symptoms. I experienced hallucinations. I experienced insomnia, panic attacks, extreme depression. All of these things are very, very common for people across the board at solitary confinement. And, of course, in more extreme situations that go on and on for years and years, people often hurt themselves, they mutilate themselves, they do anything in order to stop the monotony and to try to quiet the voices in their minds.
And both of you can kind of connect to this personally. Shane, you did a similar piece for Mother Jones, I don't know, about a year ago or something, solitary confinement. I believe I read that the U.S. now has more than 80,000 prisoners in solitary. I think some prison officials call it isolation rather than solitary. Mm-hmm. What kinds of stories were you hearing from American prisoners?
You know, what really shocked me was why people were there. You know, I focused on Pelican Bay State Prison in Northern California, and when I went into this, you know, started doing this kind of research, I assumed that people were in there because they either had committed a very heinous crime that got them in prison, or they had done something violent inside the prison. And that's certainly true for some people, but a lot of the people that I ended up corresponding with and researching their cases were there because they, you know, had some books, you know, sometimes academic books about the Black Panthers, writings about African-American history that was considered to be gang ideology by prison authorities, jailhouse lawyers. I mean, it was really incredible to me to see what the range of evidence was that constituted gang affiliation in the minds of the prison authorities. So there are people that were there for years that had not even broken rules in prison. You know, they were considered associates of a gang because of drawings they had, journal writings, books they were reading, things like that.
And what kind of response did you get from CDCR about, that's the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, about their use of solitary?
Well, they say that they don't have solitary confinement, just like every other state in the country.
They just call it isolation.
Yeah. And, you know, they told me that inmates have television, so it's not considered solitary confinement. Correctional officers bring them food to their cells, so it's not considered solitary confinement. You know, the UN definition is 22 hours a day or more alone. Pelican Bay is, you know, at least, you know, it's the only actual human interaction they have is with guards or by yelling out of their cells to other prisoners. You know, they feel that it's really exaggerated. And, you know, I had spoken with them a lot before I actually visited Pelican Bay, and you know, I was kind of prepared to actually see something that you know, was that my impression was going to be kind of more exaggerated than the reality. And when I got there, I was really shocked because I found cells that had no windows, 7 by 11 feet. People spent 20, 30, 40 years in them.
And that's journalist Shane Bauer. We're also joined by Sarah Short, and we're talking about the American prison system and their time in prison in Iran. Their new book is Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after a short break.
Your call on local public radio, KALW. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on today's program, on the phone by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or by going to yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11, it's World Have Your Say, more about the tense standoffs between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian locals as the war of words from Moscow, Kiev, and Washington grows louder. It's coming up at 11. Stay with us.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Monday, we're going to talk about the racial divide in U.S. schools 60 years after the landmark Supreme Court decision in Brown versus the Board of Education. That ruling called for desegregation of American schools. A year-long ProPublica investigation has found that many schools across the U.S. are segregated much like they were under Jim Crow. So what is the racial composition of U.S. schools today, and what parts of the country have achieved racial integration in their school systems? That's Monday on Your Call, and Rose Aguilar will be back for that. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. We're talking about incarceration and solitary confinement with journalists Shane Bauer and Sarah Short. Their new book is Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And if you have questions for Shane and Sarah, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. I'll get to some of those calls in just a minute. I was wondering, Shane and Sarah, how do you compare your incarceration in Iran and what you saw there with incarceration in the U.S.? What are some of the similarities and big differences?
It's a hard thing to compare in some ways. You know, there's in Iran, you know, we were in a political prison. People told us that they were physically tortured there. We were held, you know, without trial for 2 years, kind of went on a show trial after that. You know, but something that came up a lot in prison from the guards and from our interrogators was Guantanamo Bay. You know, there were times that I would say, you know, why are we still in solitary? Why won't you let us out? And the guards would just say, well, how long are people in solitary in Guantanamo Bay? Why don't we go to trial? It's been 2 years. How long do people go without trial in Guantanamo Bay? Hmm. And it was kind of this, you know, to them, that was a much worse situation. And it was hard for me to kind of, you know, argue against it. You know, I was kind of in this weird position where I was saying, you know, well, do you want to be better than that or something like that? And sometimes if, you know, we would hear guards beating people, Josh and I would kind of bang on the doors and they would come running and we learned to say to them, you know, what is this, Guantanamo? And they would be so insulted by that, that they would often stop, you know. So that was a comparison that came up a lot inside. You know, I think...
Because you knew that they wouldn't mistreat you in those ways.
Right, yeah, because we were in kind of a different position than most of the other prisoners there in that we were valuable to the Iranian government. You know, we were kind of a currency to them. They, you know, wanted something ultimately from our government.
That you were high-value prisoners,
right.
In that situation.
Yeah.
Before we go to call, Sarah, did you want to talk a little bit about that, the comparisons and the similarities and differences between your incarceration and the people that you're talking with here in the U.S.?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I also want to emphasize that as political prisoners, as political hostages in Iranian prison, we were very much treated along a spectrum. There were plenty of prisoners that were treated worse because they were physically tortured, and that's something that is beyond my imagination. But there were also, we were denied phone calls. The first time that we were isolated to a degree that I think is very rare, even in that context. It was 6 months before we were even allowed a phone call home. And that was because of the political nature. They wanted us to be completely unable to send any information out to our families and the public, and because they knew we would have a platform. The arbitrariness of our detention was always such a hugely just horrifying thing for me. How could it not matter that we'd come to the Middle East to do good work and to and that in many ways we'd watch the Iranian news and we would see protests against the illegal occupation of Palestine and think, well, I would be at that protest. I once even saw a friend and protest on the Iranian news for Palestine and Palestinian rights. And it just, how could it be that it didn't matter who we were? But the same, that when I compare it to prison in the United States, you often see the same thing, the arbitrariness. Many innocent people are just picked up and convicted and spend decades in prison in this country. And with solitary confinement as well, there's a woman that I've been writing for over a year now who, after her conviction, was kept in solitary confinement for 3 years and never told why. There was never any oversight, any kind of justification. And now, 8 years later, she still hasn't been given justification for that treatment.
In a recent Mother Jones article wrote about women in prisons and jails that allege sexual abuse, often getting thrown into solitary as kind of retribution for that. Let's go to Claudia in El Sobrante. Hi, Claudia. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because years ago I worked as what was euphemistically called a cottage house mother assistant, which really meant a turnkey in a juvenile detention center outside of Philadelphia. And these kids were, 16 years old at the maximum. And there was one girl who, had trouble following the rules. She would complain and she would talk back and so forth, but she certainly, wasn't doing anything that I would consider dangerously criminal. And she was locked in they had confinement cells in the basement of this juvenile detention center. And it truly was a basement. They put her in one of them, and there were no lights, and there were no windows, and just shut the door on her and left her there for 24 hours. And I opened, then they told me the next day I could let her out. And I opened the door, and it was chilly down there. I mean, I wanted to go home and, go upstairs and put a sweater on. And she was just completely covered with sweat. I mean, every ounce of her, she had water dripping off her hair. She had been sweating that badly, and she looked absolutely terrified when I opened the door, and she kept looking at me saying, "Oh, I'm so glad to see you. Oh, I'm so glad to see you." And she just looked utterly, utterly frightened.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Claudia.
Yeah. One night. Okay.
Yeah. Faye also wrote in to say a friend who's a lawyer for the ACLU was assigned to cover teen girls locked up in New York State's juvenile prisons. She turned her short assignment into a 200-plus page investigation called Custody and Control, Conditions of Confinement in New York's Juvenile Prisons for Girls. And she put a link to it at yourcallradio.org. She says, please read it, folks, and quotes from it. The children in these facilities, youth who are all younger than 16 when arrested and overwhelmingly Black and Latino New York City residents, are placed in facilities hundreds of miles from their home and families. They tend to suffer from a variety of mental health issues, substance abuse problems, and a number of other special needs. So this is talking about young people in prison. Yeah, Shane.
Yeah, I mean, even if we're talking about adults, there's evidence that, people that are released, that spend long times, periods of time in solitary confinement, that are released, have a much higher rate of recidivism. They have a whole host of psychological issues when they come out. And these are adults. When we're talking about juveniles, these are people whose brains are literally still forming. And this, I don't think we can really understand the degree of the effect that we're having when we're putting juveniles in solitary confinement. And there's, there are states that still, you know, put people, juveniles in for weeks at a time. Fortunately, there are some states that are changing their practices also. I know that Indiana has recently gone through some major reforms. They had cases of juveniles in solitary for up to 2 years, and now, if I remember right, I think the maximum is 24 hours, and during that time, there's a lot of kind of contact with family and stuff like that, and the goal is to get them out. And, you know, I think that this is kind of an important model to look at, where, you know, when somebody, whether they're juvenile or adult, is put in solitary confinement, immediately we're going to how do we get them out? You know, what do we need to do to get them out of this situation and back into, you know, integrating with other people? I mean, if the purpose of corrections is, you know, if prison is reform and rehabilitation, putting people in a box by themselves is not going to make that happen.
And Malie Hay sends us from the Center for Investigative Reporting. In March, there are thousands of teenagers in solitary. The biggest is Rikers in New York. In New York, anyone who is 16 or older is considered an adult under state criminal law. And it says solitary confinement at Rikers is officially called punitive segregation. Officials say the practice is reserved for the most dangerous inmates, but Rikers rules say 16 and 17-year-olds can be sent to the box for horseplay and noisy behavior. That's from the Center for Investigative Reporting. You're listening to Your Column. Holly Kernan in for Rose Aguilar, and it's our Friday Media Roundtable. I'm speaking with journalists Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord. Their new book is Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran, and that imprisonment in Iran led them to report on prisons in the U.S. And if you want to join our conversation about reporting around criminal justice issues and mass incarceration in the United States, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Do you follow coverage of the 2 million prisoners in U.S. Prisons and jails? And what outlets do you think are doing a good job? And if you've ever been somebody who was incarcerated, let us know about your experience. Again, the number is toll-free. It's 866-798-TALK. And let's go to Rich. Hi, Rich. Welcome to your call. Do we have Rich? Yeah, I am getting the signal that he is not with us. Do we have him? All right, let's go to another caller, or actually, would you say a few words about your friend Josh? What is he up to? Elizabeth writes to us. Shane.
Josh is now studying history. He's in grad school history at NYU.
Uh-huh.
And he now has a son. He's, you know, has a family, and he's living in New York City.
Thank you for that. And let's go to Paul. Hi, Paul. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you.
Our phone is working again. Welcome.
I was in a prison, and I was awful glad there was solitary confinement, because some of the people are really, really bad. And when they're in the Aryan Brotherhood, or whether they're in one of the Hispanic gangs, it's extremely dangerous in a prison, and solitary confinement is there for a good reason.
All right, Paul. Well, stay on the line. Let's get a response from Shane and Sarah. But let me ask you, Paul, do you think 80,000 people across the U.S. should be in solitary confinement?
I wouldn't know. I wasn't in 80,000 prisons. But in the prison that I was in, I was glad they had it.
Where were you?
I was in Salt Lake City.
Uh-huh. Go ahead, Shane. Why don't you respond to
Paul? No, I think this is an important issue. There's a big hunger strike in California last year. At the high point, there was around 30,000 people participating, and the demands of it was all around the use of long-term solitary confinement. But even these prisoners were not saying, "Let's get rid of solitary confinement." They were saying, "Let's put a cap on the time that we have there,
and have a clear path to getting
exactly.
out."
Exactly. You know, I think most people in prison wouldn't deny that there are times that people need to be isolated, especially, you know, when there's an outbreak of violence. But the other thing is, most of the people that are in solitary confinement are not Aryan Brotherhood members or, you know, these kind of core members. But the other issue is, how else can we separate these people out? You know, is it really going to help when we put them all alone? And you know, if you go to Pelican Bay and talk to the gang investigators there, they'll tell you that these guys that are in solitary are still running, you know, they're still running the show. I mean, there's no way to fully cut these people off. What do we do to kind of keep them out of the yards if that needs to happen without putting them each separately in their own box?
And for years and years, right, is part of what they're advocating for. Paul, did you want to respond to Shane, or should we let you go?
You can let me go. I said what I wanted to say, but some of those guys are so dangerous, you really wouldn't want them in a general population.
Thank you so much for calling us. Let's go to...
Can I just add to that?
Yeah, go ahead, Sarah. Yeah, please.
I think that one of the most important things to understand, apart from the fact that we know that it's not the worst of the worst, the vast majority of people in solitary are the most vulnerable population, the mentally ill, the juvenile population. But really, solitary confinement is, at best, a short-term solution to the problem. Prison guards and administrators are unqualified to deal with mentally ill inmates and also violent inmates. Prison breeds violence. So instead of actually addressing that problem, which is the core of it, where prison administrators are locking people in boxes and where they get worse and worse. And these people, the vast, vast majority of them, will be let out into our streets. And solitary confinement is shown to reduce impulse control. When I came out after a year in solitary confinement, I flew into violent rages at, over very small, petty things. It took a long time for my nervous system to go back down to normal. And so if you're talking about people that already have violent tendencies and are put in conditions that make them more violent, how does this in any way serve society? And there are other ways.
Well, I think that what Paul was saying is it served his security because he felt unsafe around a lot of these very dangerous people.
Right. But that's what I mean by a short-term solution. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's helping keep guards and other prisoners safer. But what about the fact that these people are going to be released often directly from solitary confinement into our streets? It's completely irresponsible to the general population, and it's unsafe. So if you want to look at solitary confinement from a moral standpoint, you can, because prisoners are human beings and they deserve rights. You can also look at it from a purely, community safety perspective and a selfish perspective. Do we want prisons to be turning people into potentially more dangerous citizens? And who's going to deal with them? Once they're released, the prisons are not going to deal with them.
That's Sarah Short, and she, along with Shane Bauer has written the book Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran, and since their release, they've been reporting on prison conditions in the U.S. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. We're talking about criminal justice coverage in U.S. media. The number is 866-798-8255. If you have questions for Shane or Sarah, their book is Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Again, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Trisha from San Francisco writes in, could you talk about if there are big differences in the use of solitary in for-profit prisons or detention centers versus state or federal prisons? I'm just curious if the incentives to reform prisoners is decreased when the number of prisoners directly impacts for-profit and for-profit institutions. Shane?
Most long-term solitary confinement are in public prisons, state and federal prisons. Private prisons tend to be low and medium security prisons. They have units to kind of isolate people short-term. But when we're talking about years at a time, those are going to be the state and federal, publicly run prisons.
And let's go to Shanam. Hi, Shanam. Welcome to Your Call. Hi, do we have Shanam? Have we lost Shanam? Okay, we'll get to another call in just a minute. I wanted to actually ask you about something else that you've recently written about in the edition of Mother Jones that's just about to come out for May and June. Shane, you've written about the bail bonds system, mm-hmm. and really that essentially innocent until proven guilty doesn't necessarily apply because of the way that we incarcerate so many people who simply don't have the money to pay to get out while they're awaiting trial. So First off, can you kind of explain to us how the bail bond system actually works?
Sure. We have a really unique system in this country, actually. We're the only country other than the Philippines that has a commercial bail system. So when you get arrested, say you get arrested for drug possession, you go to jail, and within a day or two, usually, you're taken before a magistrate judge or some kind of judge that sets your bail. And if you pay that bail, you can get out of jail until your trial. If you don't, then you have to wait and sit in jail until your trial. So what most people do is they can't put all that money down. You know, normally you put that money down when you show up for a trial, you get the money back. But these are really high amounts that we're talking about. So people will hire a bail bondsman who will put the money down for them, and you as the defendant pay the bail bondsman a 10% non-refundable fee to get out. And so this is kind of the basic system. But what's happening is our bail, the amounts of bail are increasing. The amounts of people that are stuck in jail pre-trial are increasing over time. And the bail industry is actually lobbying in a lot of states and nationally. They work with the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a conservative kind of bill mill that where companies...
ALEC.
Companies are kind of writing model bills that legislators then take back to their states and make law. So they're making it kind of harder for people to get out on their own recognizance for free, basically. You know, so we're seeing more and more people having to pay bail bondsmen to get out. And the result of this ultimately is that poor people are kind of stuck in jail pre-trial, which has, you know, huge repercussions. When somebody is, you know, in jail for even a month, they lose their job. And this could be for petty crimes. They lose their job. They're, you know, not there with their families. And the ripple effects are really big.
And you write that 71% of arrestees had a job at the time that they were arrested. So you talk about the cost to taxpayers of how much this is costing, but also to society.
Yeah, it costs
families
a lot of money to keep people in jail, you know.
But it's a big business.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the bail industry brings in about $1 billion a year, and there are a small amount of large insurance companies that kind of underwrite these all the kind of bail bondsmen you see, you know, around the courthouses. And these insurance companies, you know, are kind of working with legislators. They're lobbying. They're trying to, you know, change the laws to make it hard for people to get out without paying bail bondsmen.
And let me try and sneak in one more caller here. Let's go to Rich in Aptos. Hi, Rich. Welcome to your call.
Hi, thanks very much. I want to quickly tell you, anyone interested in the dealing with these issues this year to create a watershed in history, I have a plan for action which carries the imprimatur of the late Howard Zinn. For details, I want to discuss it in confidence with people, including Shane, Sarah, anyone interested. You can contact me at my home at any hour at 8:30.
Oh, okay. Hold on, Rich. Yeah. We'll just get your number offline.
Okay,
I don't want you giving it out.
Email. Can I give my email?
No, we'll get it offline. Thank you very much for that, and we'll give it to Sarah and Shane. So we were just talking a little bit about the bail bond system. Shane Bauer's article is coming out in the new edition of Mother Jones Magazine, and one of the things that you write is, all other factors being equal, defendants detained pretrial are 3 times more likely to be sentenced to prison than somebody charged with the same crimes who was released before trial. So can you talk about that? I mean, what are the factors that go into that?
This is one of the examples of the kind of much larger repercussions of pretrial detention. When somebody is held in jail before trial, it's much harder for them to get a good lawyer. Meeting with their lawyer is much more difficult. It's much more difficult for them to work on their case.
If they don't have money to pay for bail, aren't they more likely to have a public defender?
Exactly. Yeah. So they end up much more often going to prison than somebody with the exact same charge who is coming to court, you know, a free person essentially is coming from their home to court rather than from jail.
And let's go to Linda from Santa Cruz. Hi, Linda. Welcome to your call. Is Linda there? Hi.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Can you
thanks.
Hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that you have these people on. However, I think Shane is, I don't know if he missed recent, looking at Global Research website, talking about the prison industry in the United States, big business or a new form of slavery. And it's both. slavery and big business. And the for-profit corporations, they have an incentive to deny people good behavior because they can keep them in longer and then they can get more things out of them, more production, more work production. And so, you know, this is a big, big profitable area contained by two corporations in the United States. And this is the direction we're going. And those low-risk detention centers, those primarily are being used to house illegal immigrants.
All right. Well, thank you. That was Linda from Santa Cruz. And we just have a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to hear some of your thoughts about whether the tide is turning on mass incarceration that Linda just brought up, where the money is coming, you know, where the for-profit industry is at this point, and what you want people to be thinking about.
I think the tide is turning in a lot of ways. You know, our national prison population actually peaked in 2009. It's been on the decline. You see more and more public officials kind of, you know, coming out with
like Eric Holder.
Yeah. And conservative politicians, something I wrote about in Mother Jones recently, that are calling for criminal justice reforms. And, you know, as far as the private prisons, there's certainly an increase in with kind of immigrant detention centers. That's really where private prisons in this country are focusing right now. They're not growing very much in kind of regular prisons anymore. There's been cases of the Corrections Corporation of America, which is the largest private prison company in this country, building prisons on spec in California, essentially building a prison hoping that they're going to be filled, and they're not having very good luck with that these days. So, you know, I think it's too early to say, you know, what direction the private prison industry is going to go in nationally.
And Sarah, in just a couple of probably 30 seconds, what's top on your agenda for reform?
Well, there has been a shift. I mean, several states have reduced their population in solitary by simply by doing a review. In Washington State, also in Vermont, they had an internal body. I think it should be an external body. I think that's crucial for these reviews. But an internal body did a review, and up to 80% of the population was reduced in solitary confinement. So,
so that is possible.
Two to three times as much, and a lot of prison administrations are realizing that it doesn't make sense.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. That's Sarah Shord, and we've also been joined by Shane Bauer. They're both journalists and authors of the new book, Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran, and we'll put links to their recent articles, including everything that we discussed here, at yourcallradio.org, and you can continue to post articles there and continue this conversation. Thanks to both of you, Shane and Sarah, for joining us, and thanks to everybody who called and emailed. I apologize that we couldn't get to everybody. We'll put all of the resources up at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up on Monday. What is the legacy of Brown versus the Board of Education? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the landmark 1964 Supreme Court decision, which ended federally sanctioned racial segregation in public schools. A year-long investigation by ProPublica finds the resegregation of public schools across the country is now growing. So how pervasive is segregation today? And what are the best remedies for ending racial disparities in public schools? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.